Welcome. This is the Far Middle Podcast. I'm Nick DeOlias. It is early October, which means pumpkins and Oktoberfest and leaves that are turning and leaves that are falling and then leaves that need cleaned up, lots of them, at least here in Western Pennsylvania. Sometimes to the point where you think they'll never stop falling, but they will stop falling, constant listeners. They will. You just keep raking. And our dedication for episode 72 goes to honor a team in a pro league that did something in 1972, get it, 72, that no one since has accomplished, although a few teams since then have come close to matching it. And the accomplishment was going undefeated through the entire regular season and the playoffs on through to the Super Bowl. Of course, by now, the football fans out there know who I am speaking of. It's the 1972 Miami Dolphins. 17-0 from start of regular season to the Super Bowl victory. Great backfield on that team with a three-headed monster of the Hall of Famer Larry Zonka. And then you had Jim Kick. And then you have my favorite in that backfield, Mercury Morris. You had a Hall of Fame quarterback, Bob Greasy, a Hall of Fame wide receiver, Paul Warfield, and a pair of Hall of Fame offensive linemen in Larry Little and Jim Langer. So not bad on the offensive side of the ball. But went over to defense on the defensive side. You had that no-name defense that was headed by Nick Buoniconti and Dick Anderson. And that defense, by the way, made my top 10 greatest defenses of the Super Bowl era that you can peruse and read about on nickdeolias.com. I got a lot of feedback on that list. Top 10 lists tend to do that. But give it a read and let me know what you think. Yeah, the 72 Dolphins, they were stacked. But the most important piece of that team, I believe, was the coach, who, of course, was Don Shula. I think Shula may have been, you could make the argument, he's been the greatest coach in the NFL in the modern era. Apologies to Bill Belichick. Certainly, I think you could see Shula as being a top three coach of the modern era. And Shula led this team to uncharted greatness with a couple of key tactics and moves that he made sort of leading up to and during that 72 season. First thing he did, and a lot of people forget this, the Dolphins, they lost the Super Bowl in the prior year to Dallas. They got trounced in Super Bowl VI the year prior to the magic of 72. And Shula at that point was 0-2 in the big game because he also lost as head coach of the Colts before he came to the Dolphins in Super Bowl III, of course, to Joe Willie Namath, who's from Western Pennsylvania, and to the Jets, despite during that game the Colts going into it being 19.5-point favorites. So that was, of course, a huge upset. And as soon as the Dolphins were flying back from that loss in Super Bowl VI to Dallas, Shula was in the face of every player telling them to remember how bad it felt to lose like they did on the cusp of the big prize, and to basically bottle that feeling and to use it as motivation for the following season. Well, you know, certainly motivated them, and the results showed it in 72. Now, the second thing that Shula did that does not, I think, receive enough attention was bringing in during the offseason prior to the 72 regular season an experienced Super Bowl-tested backup quarterback to Greasy in the form of Earl Merle. And it proved to be an astute move, a smart one, since Greasy broke his leg and dislocated his ankle early in the 72 season. And that sounds gruesome, and I'm assuming it probably was, because I've seen in writing that Larry Zonka said that he didn't see Greasy break his leg. He heard Greasy break his leg during that play. But Merle came in, and the team didn't miss a beat or lose a game during his heading of the helm while Greasy was out. And then the third thing that Shula did that really sort of got that team to achieve to the extent that it did sort of hurts me to discuss it because it involves my hometown team. You know, Shula prepped better than anybody out there going into games. And when he made it to the AFC Championship game that was in Pittsburgh, that was against a young up-and-coming Steelers team that was coming right off of the game that was the Immaculate Reception game against the Raiders. And he noticed in film study that the Steelers, when they were lining up in special teams, sort of preparing to receive a punt, they would line up for that type of coverage that created a gap. So Shula saw this. He coached up the punter to be ready for it. And at the key point in the game, lo and behold, the Steelers lined up the way that Shula had seen that on film. The punter saw it. He was ready for it, called his own play. And what did he end up doing on fourth down? He ran for a 37-yard first down on the fake punt. It turned the momentum of the game, turned the game itself, led to the Super Bowl victory and the undefeated season that followed. So the 72 Dolphins, hey, they are classic John Facenda caliber NFL legends. Many great players on that team now in Canton. But I think the most important piece of that team was the coach, Don Shula. All right, like we always do in the far middle, it's time to run off and start connecting, making connections for episode 72. Don Shula, in that AFC Championship game in Pittsburgh, he showed he was the master of deception with the fake punt preparation and in the execution of the play on the field that turned the momentum of the game and made history on down the road. In life, there is a good side of master of deception, and there is a bad side of master of deception. So let's connect to a big, massive example of bad deception, one that is occurring in the energy policy arena, and one that is wreaking more and more havoc across economies and societies by the day. I gave a talk at the Marcellus Shale Coalition Shale Insight Conference a few days ago up in Erie, Pennsylvania, talking about what is occurring in the energy space, and I wanted to share the highlights of that talk with you. I think you'll find it interesting. I think you'll find it fascinating. I think you'll find it disturbing. And there's an odd combination for sure, but that's the type of combinations that we bring you here at the far middle. And the title of the talk was discussing Shale 3.0, sort of the next chapter with respect to the natural gas shale revolution, and really comparing and contrasting natural gas as a catalyst fuel versus a bridge fuel. So there's these views where natural gas is a bridge fuel, something that will increasingly become part of the past, part of history, no longer necessary as we make this quote-unquote energy transition. But then there is the reality of natural gas playing a bigger and more important role than ever when it comes to driving economies and qualities of life all over the globe. And I wanted to take the opportunity in that talk and on this episode of The Far Middle to sort of lay out a compare and contrast as to what's occurring when it comes to the themes in the energy policy space these days and what type of strategy or recipe it follows. Now, this issue, this debate comes down to sort of two opposing views, and I'm going to tag both of them just to make the conversation easier to follow. So on one side, you have what I call the bridgers. This is natural gas is nothing but a bridge fuel. And the bridgers are warranting that natural gas is heading toward a historical footnote. It's becoming obsolete. Bridgers employ politics and mistruths and fiction and a bit of mysticism, and their approach is the wrong approach. And it leads, their view leads to big problems for society at large. And by the way, with bridgers, under their view, who's always the answer? Who gets to decide all the time? Government gets to decide. Now, on the other side, you've got the group that I subscribe to, which are the catalysts. And the catalysts, we know that natural gas is more crucial than ever. Catalysts live in the world of science and truth and reality and fact. And our approach, of course, is the right one. We offer solutions, not just for a region and not just for our nation, but frankly for the world. And from our perspective, the free market is the answer, not government. Now, the bridgers, they've been winning the policy game of late. And you might sit there and think, well, how can that be when you've got a bridger view that's based on those things that I described, on politics, mistruth, fiction, mysticism? How can it be that a bridger view has been so successful? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute, so to speak, right? But when you think through this, actually, and unfortunately, it does make sense. It does compute. Because the success of the bridgers, it hinges on the application of a tried and true recipe that's been used by manipulators and those looking to control for decades and decades, well over a century, frankly. And the recipe itself was really laid out and exposed, explained by the great author and thinker Viktor Klemperer, when he lived under fascist rule in Germany. So he was basically making observations and keeping a diary about how the fascists came to power, how they basically grabbed a hold of power and held on to it. And he defined this recipe, which has four parts. So the first step or part is that you attack reality, and then you present in the void the made-up creations as fact. The second step of the recipe is you apply constant and endless repetition. So you're basically pounding a message everywhere so that nobody can escape the perpetual exposure to it, whether you're watching TV or you're reading the paper or you're on your smartphone or you're surfing the web or you're sitting in a classroom. Step three, now it's time, and I'm going to sort of borrow the phraseology of the great Joan Didion, to apply some magical thinking. This is where reason becomes a casualty and people embrace blatantly untrue positions. And there's almost an outward explicit hostility to any type of dissent or dissenter to such untrue positions. So this is where, if you're somebody like me, your calendar, it opens up because you stop getting invited to panels and to cocktail parties with the elite. It basically is a form of very effective and adult peer pressure. And then the fourth and last step, and this is the key because it's sort of the whole point of that recipe, it's like the payoff, is to offer up the neat, simple loan solution to the problem that these prior steps have constructed. And a solution can be a messianic leader, like it was in Germany. It can be a movement, like communism, or it can be a policy path, like we're seeing with respect to modern day energy policies. That's the payoff in the form of money, power, but most importantly, of course, control. So what I'd like to do now in the next couple of minutes is to walk you through those four steps of that recipe that Klemperer has outlined and how it applies to energy policy today and sort of explain why the Bridgers have been winning the game of late and then rebut with what the Bridgers are applying with what we, the catalysts and the doers out there, what we know to be the truth. So let's give this a go and see how it plays out. Now, if you recall, step one of this recipe, right? Attack reality and place it and replace it with made-up creations. And the Bridgers, they've successfully attacked an absolute scientific truth, which is that all activity in this world has a certain scopes 1 through 3 sort of life cycle, cradle to grave carbon footprint. And the truth has been replaced with the manufactured concept of what? Of a zero carbon economy or a zero carbon business or a zero carbon portfolio of energy. But what the catalysts know, what we know, is that while lower carbon, that's absolutely possible, zero carbon is scientifically impossible. And that continued regional utilization of things like natural gas, particularly to displace higher carbon emitting forms of energy, whether it be oil, gasoline, diesel, etc., that's going to drive carbon dioxide to the lowest level and by the most efficient path. That's the way to go. Another example of what's going on in step one of attacking reality and replacing it with these made-up creations is Bridgers covering over reality with touting that the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, and its $369 billion use of taxpayer money, that it's going to get us about a 37% reduction in CO2 by 2030. That's what's advertised with the Inflation Reduction Act. But we know that the natural gas industry is going to drop United States CO2 emissions 30% by 2030 without the Inflation Reduction Act, which means domestic natural gas, it's delivering over 80% of the CO2 drop at zero cost. And the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is eking out less than 20% of the improvement in CO2 reduction at a $369 billion cost. How about things like REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that you're seeing states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic adopting? Bridgers, right, they're hyping REGI by warranting that the states and the region's CO2 footprint, it's escalating without any type of action like a policy such as REGI. It justifies the need for wind and solar mandates and the subsidy that comes with it through government intervention. But the catalyst, we know how Pennsylvania has reduced its CO2 emissions by 40% and the United States has reduced its CO2 emissions by 23% since 2005 through what? Through the utilization of more natural gas. The United States today is utilizing 38% more natural gas than it did in 2005. Now this would, by the way, if you just looked at the state of Pennsylvania, and I sort of put out this factoid all the time, if you look at what Pennsylvania did by the embracing of natural gas and how it reduced its carbon footprint, if Pennsylvania were a standalone developed nation of its own, it would be the only developed nation to achieve the Paris Climate Accord targets. And it did it without government intervention. It did it because of the shale revolution and the natural gas and industry and the innovation that it brought to bear. Now, those pesky Bridgers, you know, they also press a popular but flawed notion that wind and solar, aka renewables, that they're carbon free. We hear that all the time, right? Well, they simply are not carbon free, because ignored are the greenhouse gas emissions that are produced during the mining and the processing and the manufacturing and the transportation of all the materials that are needed to construct these facilities, you know, as well as the activities that are associated with the maintenance and the service and the disposal of the wind turbines and the solar panels. And that doesn't even mention the redundant fossil fuel backup power that's necessary for when the wind doesn't blow or when the sun doesn't shine. So whether it is the Department of Energy or the Environmental Protection Agency or the Securities and Exchange Commission or any sort of state energy and environmental agencies across the nation, you name the government entity, where are they on calling this out, this reality out? And how can we decide our energy future when we won't be honest about the basic carbon accounting? So hopefully those examples, you know, painted the picture of how the Bridgers are applying step one of that Klemperer recipe of attacking reality and replacing it with made-up creations. Let's now move on to step two and talk about some examples in the energy policy space with how the Bridgers are pounding that message, right? Step two of that recipe was applying constant and endless repetition of a message. You know, the Bridgers, they truly excel at this step. You have to hand it to them. And you think of all the catchphrases that you see and hear everywhere these days, you know, code red for humanity, keep it in the ground with respect to natural gas, combating climate change. How many times have we heard that? Energy transition, that's another one, and a zero carbon economy, which we just mentioned a few minutes ago. The direct and indirect vilification of the domestic energy industry, the natural gas industry, it's nothing new, but it is certainly more intense, as we've seen in just the last few years. But we, the catalysts, we know the true message that needs to be broadcast. And that is that the nation in regions like Appalachia or Western Pennsylvania, they're thriving from natural gas. And natural gas derivative products and vertically expanded markets for natural gas products, right, they are the answer. All of this is going to benefit the local region and our local communities. So there's another constant chant or mantra from the Bridgers about how wind and solar are deployable at scale everywhere, including in places like Pennsylvania. And the common sense sort of rational catalysts, we know that if we want to lower global greenhouse gas emissions, then you're going to want to deploy solar and wind in the sunniest and windiest of places that still rely on higher emission sources of energy to displace them. You don't place renewables at scale in places like Pennsylvania, where the efficiencies are going to be low and the costs at scale are high and the supply chains are thousands of miles in length and the life cycle carbon footprints, as I said earlier, they're going to be in the wrong direction. You just don't do that. It's not that sunny in Pennsylvania or solar is going to have as good of a go of it as it would in places like Arizona. Yeah, you know, we doers in the catalyst mold, we're always asking that question, what's better for the planet and for greenhouse gas emissions and for regional economies and for business models? So on one hand, you could make products overseas using high emission, inefficient factories, which utilize poor labor and environmental practices, and you have all that wasted cost and energy transporting these products all the way here to sometimes work, depending on the weather. Or on the other hand, do you simply manufacture these products here with low carbon footprint natural gas, more efficient power plants and factories, adhering to stringent environmental standards, and using local well-paid workers and shipping it within a one-day's drive from, say, somewhere like Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's a pretty simple concept. So like I said, the Bridgers have been really good at pounding the message, that second step of the Klemperer recipe. The third step of the Klemperer recipe is to use, and again, I love Joan Didion, the writer who recently passed away, unfortunately, but what a great career she had, to apply that magical thinking, right? Now, what does that mean? Well, let me give you some examples of what the Bridgers are doing. So Bridgers keep incanting that slogan of increasingly competitive renewable energy. You've heard that before, surely. And how natural gas or fossil fuels in general, they're bestowed lavish subsidy by taxpayers. They get all this subsidy. But, you know, the catalysts, we understand the math of subsidy. And the University of Texas recently ran the math of subsidy for different forms of energy. And they did this on a dollars per megawatt hour basis to be able to compare things apples to apples. So what did the math show us? Well, for natural gas and oil, $1 to $2 a megawatt hour of subsidy. That's natural gas and oil. Wind, $15 to $57 a megawatt hour of subsidy. Solar, $43 to $320 a megawatt hour. So you can see, obviously, that wind and solar are getting orders of magnitude higher subsidy levels on a dollar per megawatt hour basis than something like natural gas. And another related chant that you always hear from the Bridgers, it's how the natural gas industry needs to pay its fair share, right? Paying your fair share. Under the impact fee and severance fee that we have in Pennsylvania, just by way of an example, so Pennsylvania is a good illustration of this, in 10 years' time, the natural gas industry in the state of PA provided over $2.3 billion in revenue to state communities and coffers under the impact fee severance tax. And if you look around the state of Pennsylvania, and I'm sure this is true for Texas and Colorado and West Virginia and other states that are also energy intensive, who or what has paid more of a fair share than something like the domestic natural gas or domestic energy industry has? That should be a reasonable question that should require or demand a response. And there's not going to be a response to it. And how much taxpayer subsidy, by the way, in middle-class regressive taxation, which effectively these subsidies are, did the wind and solar complex enjoy in the recent Inflation Reduction Act? Almost $400 billion or so, if you do the math. Now, another magical thought applied by the Bridgers is that wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicles, all those wonderful things, will be manufactured in the United States and in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania and the Rust Belt and those manufacturing, historical manufacturing centers. But we know, right, the catalysts know that under the laws of geology and the laws of economics, that's never going to happen. Why? Well, because the stuff you need to manufacture those things, they don't exist here, they exist elsewhere. 68% of global nickel, 73% of cobalt, 93% of manganese, and 100% of graphite in lithium-ion batteries, they're controlled by a place known as China. This is the stuff that you need for wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicles. And Bridgers paint that rosy picture of sustainability in action with wind and solar, never mind the reality that we all know too well as catalysts, right? We know that child labor in open pit mines is being employed, that there's acid runoff poisoning entire ecosystems, that there's slave labor camps in Xinjiang and China. And I don't know if you guys saw this one or not. I recently came across it. I was sort of amazed by it. In Scotland, of all places, they're cutting down 14 million trees to make way for wind projects. That doesn't seem to compute as sustainable nirvana to me. And this all ties to the bigger magical thinking concept of energy resilience that we hear from these Bridgers, how wind and solar and electric vehicles, they make the United States stronger and better positioned. But consider the true evolution that we're undergoing here. So not too long ago, we were a nation that built its grid and its transportation vehicles, but we were also a nation that relied on OPEC and the Middle East to power those things. Okay, then with the shale revolution, along comes the domestic energy industry and its innovation. What did we evolve to? We evolved to the nation that made the grid and the vehicles, and we also manufactured the energy that powered both of those. But now where are we heading with energy policy? Where are we heading with things like the Inflation Reduction Act? Now we're moving toward the Bridger's vision that's going to take us to a place where inevitably the grid and transportation fleet, they're going to be made from stuff from China and Russia, and we will also be powered by stuff from China and Russia. You know, Xi and Putin, they would like to thank the Western environmentalists and the politicians and the bureaucrats for what? For gifting them control of our energy and thus giving them geopolitical leverage. Yeah, so Klemperer's step three of magical thinking, the application of it, is certainly a key component of what the Bridgers have been doing with energy policy in this recipe. But now it's time to talk about the fourth and final step, which is offering, right, the lone sole solution or answer. And that is the payoff, as I said earlier, for the Bridgers with applying the recipe. This is where a host of answers and solutions that solve the crisis and that save the world, they come to the fore. And you see examples of this today everywhere. The Inflation Reduction Act, we've been talking about it. It is the most recent example. As I said, almost $400 billion in subsidy and support to those in the favored sort of caste system. But we look at the Inflation Reduction Act as catalysts, as doers, and we say, wait a minute, did anybody run the math to see how this proffered solution is going to impact the problem of global temperatures and rising sea levels? Well, when you plug the Inflation Reduction Act assumptions into the United Nations climate models, the UN's own climate models, which, by the way, is what noted climatologist Bjorn Lomborg has done. If you don't follow Bjorn Lomborg, you need to. He's a great thinker when it comes to climate policy. Well, the answers that Lomborg came back with the UN climate models using the Inflation Reduction Act assumptions, it comes out on the temperature side, this will impact global temperatures by 0.0009 degrees Fahrenheit, and it will impact sea levels by 0.08 inches of a reduction in sea level. Now, if you work that out and do the math, that comes out to a $411 trillion per degree Fahrenheit and $4.7 trillion per inch of sea level. And you thought that Manhattan or Californian coastal property was expensive. And how about, you know, the Bridger's answer of how a mad dash to wind and solar at scale on our grids is going to be nothing but a smooth transition. You know, the data and the reality are coming back telling us something different everywhere you look. You saw in California that it went from a best-in-class grid to a third-world grid. You saw in Texas, which is energy-rich Texas, starving maintenance investments in its infrastructure to build unneeded wind and the resulting freeze crisis that occurred. To quote the North American Electricity Reliability Corporation, quote, "There's clear, objective, conclusive data indicating that the pace of our great transformation is a bit out of sync with the underlying realities and the physics of the system," end quote. I'll second that. And, you know, things get worse when a realistic eye shifts the focus and the attention globally. That anything but smooth energy transition to wind and solar at scale in Europe, what's it done? It's emboldened Russia to invade the Ukraine. It's allowed Russia to tighten its energy grip on the EU, and it's sent inflation soaring. Meanwhile, what's going on the flip side? Russia's selling its oil and natural gas to China. China then uses that Russian oil and natural gas to fuel its industrial sector to make wind turbines and solar panels to sell to the United States and to Europe, thereby increasing its energy leverage and fueling its militarization of the South China Sea. And these policies promising the shiny soul solution, they've achieved exactly what they really intended, which is to create energy scarcity, to run up prices, and to restrict the access to energy supply. And there are all kinds of other power grabs in that final step of the recipe, the solution. It's how we end up, right, needing a climate czar who flies from elite confab to elite confab in a private jet. It's what leads to the Paris Accords and the UN positions to penalize the Pennsylvanias and the Ohios and the West Virginias and the Virginias and the Texas's domestic energy so as to do what? To force false solutions that rely on China and Russia as providers. And it's why a U.S. National Economic Council director recently asked out loud, got to give points for honesty, quote, "The question should move from why should we pursue an industrial strategy to how do we pursue one successfully," end quote. That should scare you. So hopefully walking through the great Viktor Klemperer's four-step recipe that he exposed in the context of energy policy and the Bridger's view of how they're applying that playbook, that recipe quite effectively, hopefully you enjoyed investing the time to go through that. And you could go on and on with this. There are so many other examples of each step that we could have discussed. But in the interest of time, I think you get the message. And by the way, at the Shale Insight Conference, I also spent some time going over some of the answers and solutions as to why natural gas and domestic energy, you know, holds a really bright future, not just for those industries themselves, but also for the economy and the quality of life that Americans and frankly, global citizens the world over will enjoy if we get that right and we take the catalyst fuel view of things. So give that script a read or that speech a listen if you get a chance on nickdeolias.com or on the Marcellus Shale Coalition's website or on cnx.com. I believe they're going to be available on all three. Okay, let's bring episode 72 home. Early October, it's the time when Another One Bites the Dust, that hit single from Queen, Another One Bites the Dust, hits number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in October 1980. And it stayed there for 3 weeks. It was a second single from their album, The Game, to top the Billboard charts. The first single was Crazy Little Thing Called Love. And Crazy Little Thing Called Love, it was at the top spot for 4 weeks. So we've been on a pretty successful run for Queen this time of year, back in 1980. And Queen, for me, has always been a favorite band of mine, one of my favorites. And my favorite member of the group isn't even Freddie Mercury. It's Brian May, their guitarist. That's the same Brian May who I ranked in my top 10 rock guitarists of all time list that you can review on nickdeolias.com when you get a chance. By the way, Brian May, he holds a PhD in astrophysics. I think that certainly certifies him as multi-talented. Queen, by the way, they played their hit, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, at Live Aid in 1985. Which I think Queen's performance or live performance there was the best performance of all of Live Aid and maybe the greatest live set ever, you know, beyond Live Aid itself. So give it a watch on YouTube if you've never seen it. Just type in Queen Live Aid, or if you have seen it, it's been a while, give it a look again. You'll enjoy it. It certainly was at a time when Freddie Mercury was at the peak of his powers, and you take sort of him at his peak coupled with a packed old Wembley Stadium, you know, just some magic there that occurred. They played that set around 7 o'clock, I want to say, in the evening UK time. They came on after U2 in Dire Straits, and when Queen was done, they were followed by David Bowie and The Who and Elton John and Paul McCartney. So that was a pretty good lineup for an afternoon evening, I would say. We're going to close with a line from another Queen single. The single here is I Want It All. Freddie Mercury said, not a man for compromise and wheres and whys and living lies. Listen to Freddie Mercury, constant listeners, and be that man or woman. We will talk next week. Bye for now.